Big thanks to Stackery for supporting this episode. Stackery is the global leader in international parcel forwarding from the United States. Shop at any US retailer and ship anywhere, including Europe, with Stackery.com at prices up to 80% less than directly from the store. Stackery provides free storage, same-day consolidation of your packages, and a tax-free US address. Save 10% off your first shipment with the coupon Europeans. Find the link in our show notes. Stackery is spelled Stackery.com.
Hello for the third time, and welcome to the world's greatest continental podcast, The Europeans, coming to you this week from Amsterdam and Munich. Do you know why this is the third time, listeners? It's because Dominic didn't press record.
Yeah, I didn't press record because I'm sitting crouched up in the hallway of my flat in Munich because I'm hiding from the thunderstorm so that it doesn't damage our listeners' lovely ears.
We've got a really professional setup this week, listeners. Dominic is crouched on the floor in the hallway, and I am using a towel as a microphone stand because I'm in Amsterdam this week and I forgot to pack it. And that's the closest thing I could find to a mic stand. The glamorous world of podcasting, eh?
Well, I did just listen to a really professional podcast by Preet Bharara, and his sound quality was like way worse than ours has ever been because he was on holiday. And I was like, come on, you can have a better holiday setup than that.
My holiday setup is very holiday. I'm basically using a beach towel. It couldn't be more holiday. It's a little confusing this week because I am in Amsterdam, where Dominic normally lives. And Dominic is in Munich, very wet Munich.
Where you normally live.
No, I usually live in Paris. Keep up.
Oh, it is confusing.
What are you doing there, in case people don't know?
I am here rehearsing for an opera, a piece of like quite experimental music theatre, and we're 2 weeks away from opening, which is slightly terrifying and also exciting. And I think it's going to be a really interesting piece, and we're going to be touring Europe next year, so I'll have to put like a list of all our dates, so maybe our listeners can come and see me in a show, although I'd be really nervous.
That would be so great. You could meet the fans. You could like autograph their boobs and stuff.
Shall I like tell the festival that they should sell platinum tickets for people who want to have like VIP visits at the end, like Britney?
They should. You get 5 minutes of time with Dominic Kramer, and then he takes a selfie with you and then stops smiling and talking to you immediately after.
Oh my god, by the way, that reminds me of like one of my favorite episodes of a podcast ever, which is, did you ever listen to The Mystery Show?
No, but you've told me about this, and tell everyone because it's amazing.
And you still haven't listened to it.
No, but I've heard it through you, so I don't need to.
The first episode is the presenter trying to solve a mystery whereby one of her friends who wrote a really obscure novel that didn't do very well somehow appeared on Britney Spears' like Instagram, I think. It wasn't on her Instagram. The paparazzi shot her coming out of a restaurant holding onto this book. And the guy wanted to know how on earth Britney got hold of his really obscure novel. And I don't want to give it away. You should all listen to it.
What's Britney got to do with anything?
Were you listening to that story?
No, I just can't remember how we got here.
Oh, what has Britney got to do with anything? It's to do with meet and greets.
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry.
I think I'd have to pay someone to do a meet and greet with me. and actually, after performing this opera, I think I'll need to like collapse because it's pretty heavy going.
Tell everyone about it because it is really interesting, your new show.
So it's an opera in Czech and German, but with English subtitles, or surtitles as we call them in the theatre. Mm. And it is based around two main sources of text. Letters from the family of the composer, letters that were sent either on the way to Theresienstadt or from Theresienstadt itself, the concentration camp just outside of Prague. We have these letters that we perform one by one, and it's interspersed with bits of Nazi propaganda, and we're kind of this weird conceptual killing machine on stage. It's not funny, Katie.
It's just the way you said that.
Actually, we've decided we do want it to be a bit funny because otherwise people will be really depressed.
I don't know how you're going to pull that off. That's a tricky one.
We'll get there. Just you wait.
Okay. I can't wait to see it.
Are you going
to
come and review it for the Europeans?
Yeah, for sure. I'll be like, lackluster.
Lackluster?
Your husband sent me a text message yesterday that sounded like a bad review for our podcast. Let me find it. What did he say? Not terrible, just sufficient.
Don't compare that review to us.
That's what we are. Not terrible, just sufficient.
Anyway, what have we got coming up this week?
We have got two really interesting interviews. Our first is Giuseppe Porcaro. He is the author of a new sci-fi book set in a dystopian future Europe. So we just wanted to ask him how much of that he thinks is going to happen. Our other interview is with Florian Tinnevan. I met Florian at the Charlemagne Award Ceremony in Germany a few weeks back when we were both nominated for that illustrious prize. Florian is Swedish, he is deaf, and he was there because he'd organised a talent show for deaf people from all over Europe. He is just like an awesome, awesome person. We're also going to post a couple of videos of him showing us how to do different country names in sign language and explaining why they use those signs, because some of them are pretty funny. So look out for that on our Instagram, where I have been working very hard this week, everyone. I did a story, people seem to like it, and I'm feeling really encouraged at my young person skills.
You did do a really good impression of me as well.
I did. I stood outside the National Opera and sang a little bit of opera. If that's your jam, check it out, instagram.com/Europeans podcast. We should probably get on with the show so that you don't have to stay cramped up in your little ball.
Crouched here. Okay, let's start with good week, bad week.
Good week, bad week.
So, listeners, we've got to admit something to you straight up. This is a re-record of Good Week, Bad Week, because we recorded initially on Saturday night and we'd given Good Week to the populists in Italy who looked like they'd managed to form a government. And then, boom, Sunday night comes and we've got a breaking news alert saying the Prime Minister designate Giuseppe Conte has failed to form a government and he has given back the mandate. So it wouldn't really feel right to keep them in Good Week, would it, Katie?
Definitely not a good week. What happened?
Quite a lot happened. And I don't mind that much because I wasn't that comfortable with giving the Italian populace good week. So, ha, bad week. Italian populace have bad week.
They were having a good week until it went horribly wrong.
They were kind of having a good week, although there were already signs that things were going wrong. Let me give you the lowdown, although it's just happened. So we must say that like things probably will have changed by the time you've heard this. Last week, the two populist parties that did very well in the March elections, they are the anti-establishment five-star movement and the populist right-wing league. They finally came together and announced a coalition agreement and they nominated a former law professor, Giuseppe Conte, to be PM. Is he a former law professor? Is he?
I mean, I don't know. We can't trust anything he says anyway, so.
Well, that's true. He claimed that he was studying at New York University and Girton College, Cambridge, both of which it turned out he just like had access to use their libraries a bit.
He was just hanging out. That's fine.
He was just hanging out, yeah. Things were a bit wobbly with that, with Conte's nomination, because he was accused of lying, which he denies. But then the poo really hit the fan around the nomination of the 81-year-old Eurosceptic Paolo Savona as finance minister. In brief, the president of Italy, Sergio Mattarella, is staunchly pro-Europe. He does have the prerogative to block nominations of ministers, but it is very rarely used. In this case, President Mattarella opposed the nomination of this Eurosceptic man because he argued that it would send the markets out of control as his policies are seen as so extreme and so Eurosceptic. Actually, it wasn't just to do with Euroscepticism, but he argues that it's very extreme. And because of this refusal to accept the finance minister, Giuseppe Conte, the prime minister designate, decided to hand back the mandate. And this could end up with new elections, although this news has literally just broken, so we don't quite know what's going to happen. There's suggestions that Mattarella is going to try and form a neutral government. And then there are also calls already for him to be impeached. So, yeah, drama. It's like an Italian opera.
Crazy times. I think we could probably say it's been a better week for Brussels than it looked like it was going to be, because this government that the populists were going to form looked like Brussels' absolute worst nightmare. Five Star wanted loads of increased spending, and the League, who are very hard right, wanted tax cuts. So that was definitely going to result in Italy's debts going up, and Italy's debts were already like way out of control, which Brussels is always very, very antsy about. So, good news for Brussels, I guess. Although, maybe there's a constitutional crisis on the hands, so not good news.
I don't think it is, and I think in the long run, it's going to mean a strengthened far-right party and anti-establishment five-star movement, maybe.
Although, by the time that anyone actually hears this, who even knows where we're going to be?
Yeah, actually, we shouldn't make any predictions, should we?
In Brighter news. It's been a very, very, very good week for Ireland. Unless you've been banished from the internet this week, you will know that Ireland has voted to lift its ban on abortion. We were wondering whether we should try to somehow be neutral on this topic, which obviously stirs a lot of emotion on both sides of the debate. But
no.
Screw it. I'm a woman. I'm pro-choice. It's an amazing week for Ireland, full stop. There's been a landslide victory, 66.4% in favour of overturning this really incredibly cruel part of the constitution, which banned abortion even in cases of rape and forced thousands of women every year to have babies that they didn't want, or travel abroad, or buy pills on the internet and just kind of hope for the best. So it's a massive victory for women's right to do what they want with their bodies. One thing I did think was really striking was that a lot of people said in the exit poll that it was hearing personal stories from women who'd had unwanted pregnancies that really settled it for them. So it's thanked in large part to the bravery of women who spoke publicly in the media about something that's really been pretty taboo until now, that this referendum turned out the way it did. So, women of Ireland, we salute you.
We do. And I think we could also argue it's been a bad week. Well, it's been a good week for the exit pollsters who suggested this landslide victory, but it's been a bad week for the final polls, which suggested that it was like tightening at the last minute and that it might not win. So I need Nate Silver really to come and talk to us about that, because I'm not qualified.
Nate Silver, come on the show.
Please come on the show, Nate Silver. I love you.
Do you?
Yeah, I really enjoy his podcast as well, 538 for American Politics. It's one of my favourites. They've got a really good mix of fun chat and amazing political analysis.
Just like us.
Just like us.
Our first guest this week is Giuseppe Beccaro. Giuseppe is a kind of modern day European Renaissance man. In his day job, he is the head of communications at Bruegel, which is a economic think tank based in Brussels. And on the side, he's a part-time DJ, and he's just written a sci-fi novel set in a dystopian Europe, which is kind of a semi-recognizable Europe. There's things that you might recognize from the Europe that we know, and unsettling elements from one that we don't. He's literally just launched the book in the last half hour, and he is on the line from Brussels.
I mean, maybe as an Italian, you're also used to having rather questionable leaders. It's been quite a few decades with quite a few leaders that don't have the best record, I think we could say.
Well, you're referring to Berlusconi, obviously.
Maybe.
And pre-Berlusconi, what was his name? The guy who ended in exile.
Bettino Craxi.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. But I think this time is different. In Italy, we are very good with creating new political imagination, I would say. Perhaps this is also a little bit about what the book speaks about. Berlusconi created a new form of doing politics back in early 90s, and definitely what is happening now in Italy, it's a new form of politics that we don't really know what to expect from. And I mean, from an analysis perspective, it is pretty different from anything we've been seeing before. So from that point of view, after 20 years, we can say, yeah, Italy is innovating again in politics. Then one can say, is it for good or for bad? This is a different, totally different kind of discussion, of course. But many people voted for Berlusconi in early 90s, and they thought it was going to be something new and something fresh. So who knows what's going to happen now?
Speaking of something new and something fresh, your novel's pretty new and fresh. See what I did there? Obviously, don't spoil the plot for anyone, but can you set out the kind of world that your book is set in?
The book is set in a parallel timeline where in 2008, when the big financial crisis was going on, instead of seeing what we've been seeing, a civil war broke in Europe, all over the continent, and led to the collapse of member states. This left the European Union as the only entity with a certain grip on the rule of law. And the book is set in this post-war timeline where at the eve of the first European elections after the war. And in this setting, a digital entrepreneur would like to sell an app to the government to replace elections with something that is similar to Tinder, the dating app. So let's say the question is on the table, what if Tinder-like app would replace elections.
It's terrifying. So it's terrifying, but it's also quite comic, your book. It's kind of like a satirical dystopian novel. And do you see it actively as like a form of activism, writing this book?
Yes. The process of writing fiction can be a methodological tool to ask questions about what's going on politics today in general. But in this specific case of Disco Sour, it was a methodological tool for a certain European activism, because actually I found out that there are very little imagination about multiple narratives that we can have around Europe, first of all. And then secondly, there are very little fictions, science fictions, TV shows that sees Europe as somehow the background or the center where an interesting story is revolving around. So from this point of view, yes, Disco Sour is trying to bring something new on the table that is about Europe, and it's a little bit different.
I mean, obviously, this is based on a kind of parallel reality. To what extent is it based on stuff that you actually think could happen in Europe in the future?
Well, the thing is that when I started to write Disco Sour, it was late 2014. And for example, I wrote about Brexit, and Brexit was not even there. And then Brexit happened, and then I was starting to say, oh my God, the things that I'm writing in the book are starting to happen.
Ah.
One day, like during the primaries, the US primaries last year, what happened is that I scrolled down my news feed on Twitter, and then I find out that Tinder is proposing a widget for the US election called Swipe the Vote, where they are matching the candidates with the preferences of people. To say, oh my God, I mean, I need to get out this book. I need to finish this book as soon as possible, because otherwise this kind of science fiction is not going to be science fiction anymore. It was quite crazy seeing these things happening in real, you know, at the same time, the book writing.
Yeah, oh God, it sounds like, yeah, and a kind of arms race with the real world. As you said, there's a lot of inspiration from the real world. I think it's not too difficult to understand why you might want to write a novel about the breakdown of democracy in Europe with technology playing a part. But was there one specific event that made you want to write this novel initially?
There were two events, basically. One, which is without spoilers about the plot, but basically was linked to a mission I made in Chile back in 2013, where I missed 3 connecting flights in 3 days and in 3 continents. And then the second inspiration were the actual European elections in 2014, where I was directly involved in campaigning for getting young people to vote. I was back then the Secretary General of the European Youth Forum. And we did this campaign called the League of the Young Voters, in which frame we organized the first televised presidential debate. After that, there was a lot to digest about what was going on in European politics back then. There were the premises of what we are seeing nowadays, let's say, like the rise of the populist parties, nationalism, and so on. So I want to take a little bit stock of all this kind of experience and trying to see how I can fictionalize all this and how we can build a different narrative around that.
Is this the start of a series, Giuseppe? Are you going to write any more dystopian European stories after this?
I would like to write more European stories. Even Disco Sour, I don't qualify it as a dystopia as such. It's a science fiction. You know, there are some dystopian elements, but there are also some utopian elements inside. For example, there is this universal syncretic religion where you have all different elements from different religions. And this is some sort of, you know, like respecting cultural differences. It's a very queer, respectful word as well. Like gender roles are also quite fluid in that. So, I mean, there are certain things that seems dystopian, certain things that seems utopian. What I think that this is like an alternate reality. So as an alternate reality and should mirror our own reality, we also have in our own reality certain things that are very dystopian and other things that are better, hopefully.
Do you think the Eurocrats and people living in Brussels, where you live, will take notice of this novel and hopefully heed from the warning you are sending them? Or do you think it will entertain them mainly?
Well, first of all, I don't think that it's particularly pointing the finger at Eurocrats as such. You know, it's pointing the finger at a certain way of seeing Europe as the scapegoat for any kind of problems that there are at the moment in Europe. So it's more of a broader kind of reading of this, so which I hope is going to be read outside the Brussels bubble. But then for the Brussels bubble itself, it's also a sort of self-reflecting, mirroring experience in terms of what do we get right, what do we get wrong, you know, and perhaps and especially what I would like to get out of it is a conversation about the fact that you can have different views and different narratives, but within the system. What we've been witnessing in the past years is like, either you are against the system or you are within the system. I think in order to have a healthy democracy, there should be different visions of the future, different visions about what do we want politics to do, including European politics, including national politics and so on, and bring this dialectic within the democratic discussion, not the us versus them and, you know, the Tinder politicization of things, which makes things very simple, swipe right or swipe left.
That really rings true for me. And I mean, it's one of the reasons why Katie and I set up this podcast, to kind of start seeing if people were interested in thinking about Europe and what Europe could do. And also we've realized how little art there is that kind of reflects Europe as a whole. There aren't that many novels or films or theatre pieces. Maybe there's actually slightly more theatre pieces than anything else that look at Europe and particularly at Europe's institutions. So I think it's great that you're doing this. And most of our listeners are outside of the Brussels bubble, so hopefully some of them will give it a go and it will indeed reach far, far beyond Europe itself.
To the edges of the Federation.
Yes.
Our next guest is Florian Tjernovan. He is a super cool guy who I met in Aachen when I was there a few weeks ago. He is many things. He is a Swede. He is an amazing poker player. He also happens to be deaf. And he was there because he'd been nominated for the prize, same prize as us actually, for doing something a lot better than doing a stupid podcast. He organized a talent show for deaf people from all over Europe. And Florian basically argues that deaf people have all of these talents that they don't get to show off in the same way that hearing people do. For example, there are like really few jobs for deaf actors. Marlene Matlin from The West Wing being one of the few examples.
Love her.
But obviously the opportunities are few and far between. So Florian just wanted to get out there and celebrate deaf people's talents and also bring together this community from all around Europe who all have this thing in common. And we had some really interesting chats while we were in Germany through his interpreter. Maybe you already know this, but I kind of knew this, but not really. Most countries have their own sign language, and some countries, several varieties of sign language are used. But when people get together internationally, they use international sign language, which Florian compares to like using the role that English does when people from different countries get together. It's kind of just like the lingua franca, I guess.
It's Esperanto.
Oh, yeah.
It's the dream.
Sure. I mean, we are yet to start learning on Duolingo, but we are going to get around to that at some point, you and I. But anyway, Florian and I talked about that. We talked about how proud he is of deaf culture. We talked about all kinds of things. And I very much hope that you enjoy hearing from him as much as I did. It's a little noisy. We were speaking on the edge of a music festival, and the voice that you're going to hear is his interpreter. And I started by asking him what it was like hanging out with hearing people from all over Europe while we were in Germany.
I really enjoy my time here, meeting new people. And in the beginning, the first hours, deaf people, typically hearing people, quite afraid of deaf people. Well, how to communicate. I mean, I'm really happy that I found many hearing people who try to communicate. I think that's all that matters. Humans, we have to communicate across differences. And as time went by, I have now some hearing friends who are really good at gesturing and are really talented.
Have we been doing any embarrassing gestures or stupid gestures in sign language without realizing it while we've been here this week?
None for the radio. Nobody has made stupid signs. Yes, but there are hearing people who will try to talk into my ears instead of talking to the interpreter. And I sort of had to redirect them and say, no, it's the interpreter listening to you, not me.
I mean, that should be quite obvious. And we're all very intelligent people here. So I don't know why everyone's been doing that. Tell me a little bit about why you're here and what your project is.
My project is about a European talent show for deaf people. And every participant was 100% deaf. And we had people from many, many different countries. And there's so many deaf people with so many skills without opportunities to show them. Because in hearing theater or dance troupes, some deaf individuals try to be included, but very often they're socially sort of excluded. They can't pay for interpreters or can't get interpretation, lose their motivation. And we want really to encourage deaf people to be more active in arts, culture, poetry, everything.
What were your favorite performances from the talent show?
Oh, there were so many. One I liked is a guy from Russia, amazing with his hands. And he used sign language, and he does just amazing ballet with his hands. I can't even copy it.
You'll have to send me the video later so we can share it on our Facebook page. But tell me, how do you guys communicate when you're all together, different people from Europe who are all deaf? Do you speak international sign language, or does everyone like speak then? Because I know there are national sign languages which are all can be very different from each other. How does it work?
We have an international sign. Of course, all countries in the world have their own sign language. And international sign is basically a salad with signs composed of signs from different sign languages. And international sign is not a language as such, but it's a combination of mime. For hearing people, actually, if they want, it should be easy to pick up international sign. And basically, I think all hearing people should know some international sign.
It's been quite fun this week learning from you some signs. We were really enjoying yesterday learning some of the country ones. It was hilarious. You were showing me the word for Great Britain, which is... I'll post a little video of what it looks like, but it's basically a sign that means a country that's taken over loads of territory from other people. So I'd just like to apologise for British colonialism. When you had this gathering of like young deaf people from around Europe, did it give you a chance to talk about like how deaf people are viewed in different countries around Europe? Did you discuss that much?
Absolutely. We're discussing so many different topics. How can strengthen the deaf community? Deaf community is already very small, and every day nowadays it's getting smaller because there's all kinds of technologies that make deaf people think they can hear again. For example, cochlear implants. Cochlear implants don't make deaf people hearing people. They get some sound awareness, but they're still deaf. And many parents, when they give birth to a deaf child, won't expose the child to sign language and think the child with this implant will become hearing. So whenever we meet, of course, I'm very so proud of myself and my culture. Even if I could become hearing tomorrow, I wouldn't do it. I hope my kids will be deaf, and I want deaf community to stay strong.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit yesterday about how, you know, with the rise of these cochlear implants and things like that, sign language might die out. Would that really represent like the death of a culture for you?
I think sign language will never die out worldwide, but in Europe, sign language is definitely decreasing. Some researchers say that 95% of the children born deaf nowadays receive a cochlear implant. And of course, within every country, there's still very strong deaf communities. If you look at the United States, deaf community is so strong, and I think it'll never die out. In Europe, it'll diminish.
Are there some countries in Europe where it's easier to be deaf than other countries in Europe?
Yes, there are countries where it's easier for deaf people to become engaged in sports. In other countries, there's some deaf individuals who become politicians. No country's paradise for deaf people. Some countries, yes, are more advanced than others. But then those countries who are less advanced tend to catch up quite rapidly. So within Europe, I'd say the situation is quite similar.
You were saying in the ceremony yesterday that your skill at the talent show was organizing all of this. What else do you have planned?
I like organizing, but I do have some other secret skills. I am a stand-up comedian, which I want to develop more, and I want to perform for mixed audiences.
I did actually ask Florian to tell me a joke at the end of that interview in sign language, but his interpreter ruined the punchline, so I didn't include it for Florian's sake. That's the thing about being a deaf comedian. Like, your interpreter also has to have really, really good comic delivery, or you are screwed.
That's really difficult. I was actually wondering, I realised how ignorant I am about what life is like for deaf people. Could it be that there was an interpreter that he could work with like often, or presumably every like event he goes to, there's just a different interpreter provided by the event?
He actually had two interpreters because they were like really, really long events. And it was interesting watching them because they would take it in turns. I think it's quite tiring doing like live sign language interpreting. So they would do like 10 minutes each and then swap and rotate. But that's a good question.
So like when all the old men were speaking in the conference and you were all bored and like messaging each other, did the interpreter have to sign all of that?
Yeah, and I actually asked Florian, like, was that really annoying for you? Because the rest of us were just like playing on your phone. Did you feel obliged to keep looking at your interpreter? And he was like, yeah, you know, it's kind of fine. It's just like, if you aren't watching your interpreter constantly, you do miss things. So you have to keep paying attention, which is annoying for him. But yeah, he's just a really, really cool guy. And as mentioned, we're going to post a couple of videos of Florian teaching us some fun words in sign language. So look out for those on Facebook and Instagram.
This week's happy ending was brought to my attention actually by my father-in-law. Shout out, Hans.
Hey, Hans.
And you are going to love it, Katie, because it comes from your part of the continent.
Oh, yeah?
Essex.
Does it?
Yeah.
Our first Essex happy ending.
Yeah.
Can we just explain what Essex is for foreigners?
I was about to. So it's an English county. So it's like a part of England, just northeast of London. Up till now, it's been most famous for introducing the world to vajazzling, which you should Google, as you know, don't. Also, it's really famous for a trashy kind of Jersey Shore style reality TV show called The Only Way is Essex.
Yes.
But that's no longer going to be the case because they've now got a new hero, which I imagine you've heard about, Katie, because you're from there.
No, I don't know what you're talking about. What's this?
You don't know about Fred the Labrador?
No.
Oh, God, he's such a failure. Call yourself an Essex girl.
I've been on a holiday for the last few days.
Okay, well, Fred is a 10-year-old dog who lives at Mount Fitchett Castle.
Stands to Mount Fitchett. We went on a school trip there.
You did? Oh, good. At least you know where that is. You're not a total fraud.
We fed all our assignment sheets to the goats instead of doing them. It was great.
Oh, that's really bad for the goats.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to Fred. He shot to fame last week after he adopted 9 baby chicks whose mother had sadly disappeared.
Oh.
Isn't that so sweet? The chicks apparently immediately took to him. And the castle promptly organised a cynical photo shoot.
Obviously.
With the chicks sitting around Fred and even one with the chicks lined up on Fred's back. Oh, isn't it so nice when animals are friends?
Do you think they're actually friends or do you think he's going to like roll over in his sleep and, you know?
Yeah, I think probably they gave him some like dog Valium and made him just place these chicks around him.
It's all a lie.
It's all a lie, but it's still the soppiest happy ending ever. I'm going to post the photos on our Facebook page, which you can find if you type the Europeans into Facebook. So check it out there.
Do it. I think we should reenact it as well. Like stage a little photo shoot with you and me dressed up as a chick and a dog. I'm just thinking aloud here.
Who's going to be the chicks?
You'd make a very nice Labrador, so I'll be the chicks.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Europeans. We would love it if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts, which is aka iTunes, but we're not allowed to call it that anymore.
Don't call it that.
Sorry.
50 euro cents in the swear jar.
Okay. We have a nice email address. I mean, it's an okay email address.
Do we?
It's europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
It's an absolutely delightful email address.
If you like the email address, then you could give the email address a review as well. That's fine.
Please do. Just let us know how you feel about the whole thing in general. We would love to hear from you. As previously mentioned, we are all over the internet in between episodes. We are on Facebook at Europeans Podcast and on Twitter at Europeans Pod and Instagram, Europeans Podcast. Thank you also to our very lovely composer, Jim Barn, who we don't thank enough these days. He is wonderful. Let me just put that on the record. And he is available for all sorts of very well-paying musical assignments.
As are we.
As are we.
As a duo.
Now that I sing as well.
Yeah, apparently.
Actually, you know how you were saying in the interview with Giuseppe about how there's not enough Euro films and stuff?
Yeah.
Maybe we should make one. Maybe we should star in a sort of new romantic comedy.
What? We would be the romantic leads?
Yeah, well, I feel like we'd be the couple that, you know, doesn't seem like it's going to work, but ultimately it does.
Oh, I was thinking it'd be the opposite. We were the couple that, like, were pretending to be together and then it turned out I was gay.
Oh, that's less cheerful and more repressed.
Anyway, can I get out of the ball on the floor that I'm tied up in at the moment?
Get out of your ball.
Can I go and stretch my limbs and see if I've got any blood left in my legs?
Dominic's now going to go out and stretch for the whole of the next week until we see you again. We very much look forward to it. Have a great week, Europe, and we will see you, as always, next Tuesday.
Tschüss.